those gaps has not narrowed. Just 12.7% of Black fourth graders scored proficient or advanced in English language arts, compared to over half of their white peers. UW-Madison sociologist Eric Grodsky traces the problem and the solutions back to kindergarten.
If you really want to resolve disparities, try to prevent them from happening in the first place. And so getting kids to school on a more even footing would go a long way toward preventing them in the first place.
Grodsky says how much a parent earns affects how well a child does in school, and that systemic poverty is a big part of the achievement gap. Phoebe Petrovic, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up on 11 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check sports and weather. Major League Baseball, the Brewers won the division tiebreaker with the Cubs 3-1. The Dodgers won their division tiebreaker with the Rockies. So, the Cubs will host the Rockies in the wild card game tonight, 7 o'clock at Wrigley. The Brewers will then host the winner of that wild card game starting on Thursday. Monday Night Football, the Kansas City Chiefs remain undefeated as they edged the Denver Broncos 27-23 last night. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Tuesday, October 2nd. Cloudy and seasonal, today's high 63, tonight's low 55. We get a warm day tomorrow with a high of 83, then we're back into the 60s. This morning, humidity 92%, wind northwest at 5, it's cloudy. 55 degrees across the board. Racine, Kenosha, Burlington, Elkhorn, Lake Geneva, and Milwaukee. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg.
The next few minutes of WGTD's morning show will be spent exploring a very interesting story, that of the so-called Lumbee Indians of North Carolina. The Lumbee Indians are the largest tribe of American Indians east of the Mississippi, with a population of some 70,000 or so. And their history is exceptionally interesting and also complex. And it is explored by someone who has studied it extensively and also, to some extent, lived it herself, since she is part of this tribe herself, Dr. Melinda Maynor Lowry, Associate Professor of History and Director for the Center for Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And her new book is called The Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle, published by the University of North Carolina Press. Dr. Lowry, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
I hope you won't mind us just spending a minute or two talking about the fact that this is a rescheduled interview. We were to have spoken, I think, a little over a week ago, and that interview had to be postponed because of the encroachment of the most recent hurricane on the Carolinas. And, of course, all of us all around the country watched with concern and mounting horror as we saw events there. I wonder if we could just find out from you what you have, in a sense, lived through over the last few days and how things are with you and your loved ones.
Well, thank you for asking. And I also appreciate everyone's concern, because this has been a truly life-altering, perhaps generation-altering event. I live about 2 hours away from our homeland in Robinson County, North Carolina, in the southeastern part of the state. So my specific area and the immediate family I have that lives here were escaped unscathed for the most part, but I have extended family, aunts and uncles, cousins, and many other relatives who are really feeling the brunt of the storm still, as waters have just now started to recede in many places. People have all kinds of housing damage, especially roof damage, trees down. Power is restored for the most part, but food has also been a critical issue, and people have mobilized from all over the country, including groups like World Central Kitchen, to bring food to the Lumbee community. One of the biggest concerns, historically speaking, about this storm is the damage that's been done to priceless artifacts and collections in some of our community homes, as well as institutions such as the Indian Education Program, which is housed in the historic Indian High School in the town of Pembroke, North Carolina. That building was severely damaged due to the wind and rain, and as a result, our artifacts are left exposed, our collections are damaged, and where people are working now to try to salvage what they can.
I wonder if you could just say a word about what this has meant for the citizens of North Carolina in terms of some who were very directly impacted and others like yourself who, in a sense, escaped the most sort of brutal impact of this storm, but nevertheless are feeling it in all kinds of different ways. I mean, at the moment, what is life like for those who live in North Carolina, whether you are part of the former or the latter?
Right. Well, if you're part of the latter and you didn't experience the storm, but you have close friends and family who did, it's very emotional for us to see our burial places flooded, to see our river expand well beyond its bounds to cover houses and roads and landmarks that we know really well and that we love. Of course, the damage to people and their lives is very critical too. From a distance, the damage to or the changes in the land are really obvious. From the people I've talked to who are there and going through this process, that's, I don't know that most of us are in a recovery stage yet. Those that went through the storm, they're not yet really recovering. They're still trying to assess damage and trying to figure out just what to do next. But they are, from what I understand from friends and family, in shock to a certain extent, but they're also determined to stay and build and rebuild. Many people did not evacuate. Of course, evacuation orders did not reach our homeland before the river flooded. But, you know, those who had the opportunity to evacuate, only a few of them did. Those who stayed seemed to be just determined that they would contribute to their community after it was over. You know, they didn't want to be stuck out somewhere else, and they wanted to stay so they could help everyone recover.
Are you referring to the Lumber River?
Yes, the Lumber River is the kind of main water artery of our landscape.
Right, and in your book at some point you mentioned that it is also known as Drowning Creek.
Yes, its first English name, anyway, was Drowning Creek, and that was due to the very rapid kind of undercurrents that exist in that river. It's a very small, in some places, kind of river that snakes along through a wetland area that is also full of swamps and branches off those swamps. And the river itself has had a reputation for causing accidental drownings for many, many years. Of course, it became the Lumber River after timber companies came in, began to cut the longleaf pine trees in the area and use the river to float those logs down to Georgetown, South Carolina, where it ends.
Well, there's certainly painful irony in its other name of Drowning Creek, and we certainly wish only the best for those who live along its bank and everyone impacted by this storm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Melinda Maynor-Lowry. We are about to begin talking about her most recent book, which is called The Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle. I think before we go any further, we need to talk about terminology, because, of course, that is an issue fraught with some tension, sometimes controversy. And, of course, when we are talking about this particular population in the broadest sense, there are all kinds of terms that have been used, including American Indian, Native American, Native, Indigenous, and and you call it a complicated question without an easy answer in terms of what terms to use. You actually prefer the term American Indian, and that is, at least for the most part, the term that we see used in your book. Explain why this is the term that you think it makes sense to utilize, within this particular book you have written.
Right. Well, you're right that it's all about context. So too often I think we use words without considering their intimate and more distant contexts. And in the case of a word like American Indian or the analogs, Native American, Indigenous, et cetera, different peoples who are indigenous to their landscapes use words differently throughout the world. So folks in Canada, for example, would never refer to themselves as American Indians. That's not a legal term that relates to them. It's not a term that they themselves embrace. They use the term First Nations. In North Carolina, the historical record uses the term Indian or American Indian most often, but it kind of strikes to the heart of the Lumbee and American story to think about how labels have changed over time and how easily we can forget the context for those labels. So in the case of Lumbee history, racial labels like mulatto or Indian have been used, and sometimes the same people have been referred to in different ways, sometimes as white, sometimes as black as well. And that reflects the context of a biracial South. But Lumbees themselves have embraced different tribal names over time, sometimes calling themselves Croatan, sometimes Siouan Indians of the Lumber River, sometimes even Cherokee Indians of Robeson County. We know that that's historically not an accurate name. And now we refer to ourselves as Lumbee. And that process really speaks to how labels can only serve a few purposes. And what we really need to do is make personal decisions informed by history and context when we're thinking about what's most appropriate to use. So when someone's trying to make a decision, I try to help them understand what context they're trying to reach. If it's a national context, then a phrase like Native American might be the most clear and the most obvious. But here in North Carolina, our state residents know us as American Indians, and we know ourselves that way. That's what I grew up calling myself and hearing from my relatives. So that's the term I particularly decided to use in the book for the most part.
Very good. That's the term we will use through the course of this interview, certainly. I would love to hear from you a little bit about the challenge of exploring the history of the Lumbee Indians. Those are probably very closely related to the challenge that would face any historian wanting to explore the history of any such tribe, right? Or just about anything, but in particular, I should think in particular when we're talking about a history that we think of, at least we on the outside think of as very orally based, that perhaps there is not quite the same written record as there might otherwise be, and or maybe much of that written record is the written record of so-called whites, and their interpretation of certain events. So could you just talk for a moment about the challenge that you faced in trying to explore this particular history and what turned out to be most valuable for you in that exploration?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think most historians of American Indians would say that erasure is the first challenge that they have to confront. So whether it's further back in time or even sometimes more recently, American Indians are just not as visible to Europeans who are doing most of the writing, not all of it. Of course, we do actually have quite strong written records by American Indians going back in some cases and some places to the 1700s. But you have to have some skill in interpreting those records sometimes. And in the case of North Carolina, there were not a lot of Europeans here to write about our ancestors before, say, the 1730s. The territory that we live in really was not settled by Europeans before that time. And so the kind of record that we have is clouded by a sense of Europeans not observing or just simply not remarking on whatever they do observe. And there's kind of a saying that I heard from a Lakota elder some years ago that you don't know how to accurately describe a culture unless you know what you're seeing. Mm. And I think Europeans often would look at different American Indian tribes and just not simply understand what they're seeing. So whatever they wrote down was at least to some measure inaccurate. And now it's our job as historians to go back and kind of read between the lines and let that information be informed by what Native people themselves have said, as you said, an oral record. And the method of oral history is one that I'm deeply attached to and I have used a lot in my research. That's a method that affirms that you don't have to be important for your life to be history, that you can record your life, you can tell your story, and that historians will use that information in the same way that they will use whatever's written down in the documentary record. So for me, I think the key to dealing with that sense of invisibility has been to combine different types of sources, some of them oral and some of them written, some of them coming from folks who were observing us from an anthropological point of view, some of them coming from settlers or people who are our neighbors, and then using that to kind of inform what Lumbee people themselves talk about when they talk about their identities and their history. Hmm.
I want to be sure to ask you about something that you mentioned in the acknowledgments that intrigues me so much, and that is, in addition to everything else that was of tremendous help to you, you talk about a tape recording that your father made.
Mm-hmm.
That, and I'm not sure in actuality how valuable it was to you in this particular project, but it meant enough to you to receive very special mention in the acknowledgments. Please explain to our listeners what this tape was all about and what it meant to you then and now.
Well, so when I was 5 or 6, my father sat down with my great uncle, his uncle, Dolly Maynor, and Uncle Dolly was a pastor, a church leader, who also, like many of our Lumbee elders, the vast majority of them, had an extensive knowledge of his ancestors. And so this particular tape recorded my Uncle Dolly recalling all of our Maynor genealogical tree going back into the late 1700s. And so that type of oral testimony is something that our young people, even now, still hear on a routine basis. It's a kind of ritual for Lumbees to gather together and talk about our ancestors, say their names. If there are pictures of them, photographs, we'll point to their photographs and name everyone in the photographs. And those kind of rituals were very common from my youth, and that was, a key kind of way to inform my sense of myself as a Lumbee people, as a Lumbee person, that was also very tied to the history of our people. So I wasn't just getting information about being Lumbee from the present moment. Being Lumbee was always all about what this history is and who your ancestors are. And later on, it became a kind of research tool. It became a source. But it's always, I think, first and foremost, been ingrained in me as part of our identity that informs my relationship to my community. So I wanted to thank my father in particular for not only making the recording, but then saving it for me to listen to
30 years later after the fact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're speaking with Dr. Melinda Maynor Lowry about her new book called The Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle. It explores the rich and fascinating history of the Lumbee Indians and the way in which they have been viewed, and some of the splits actually within the Lumbee tribe as they have sought to, in a sense, establish their own identity and their place in the larger American landscape around them. One of the things that's quite intriguing is explored in the first chapter of your book, in a sense, the origins of the Lumbee Indians, their origin stories, and they are many and varied. One of the most interesting statements you make in this chapter is this. You write, "Outsiders trying to analyze Lumbee origins lose themselves in the wrong questions." That's a great statement, and I think it's in part, it's interesting beyond the context of this book and this topic, because chances are we make that mistake all the time when we are an outsider looking in on anything or anyone. Yeah. We probably often get caught up in the wrong questions. In this particular context, what are some of those wrong questions that outsiders tend to be a little too fascinated with,
right,
to the expense of more central and valuable questions?
Yeah, I think the singular one that pops to my mind is this question of where the Lumbees come from. Who were our historic tribal ancestors? And trying to solve that, to nail down a single historic tribe from which we descend, is an unanswerable question from my perspective as a historian. There's a lot that we know from oral testimony and from that kind of reading between the lines activity, and I do discuss that in my book, what we can know, I discuss. But it's impossible, based on the documentary record, to define a particular single historic tribe from which we descend. And the more logical conclusion is to talk about why we came to be and to talk in particular about what we're doing now. The answer to those subsequent questions, the why we came to be and what we're doing now, are things that not only kind of affirm our existence in the present day, but they also signal to non-Indians that this obsession with defining particular origins is not only an unanswerable question, but it's one that fixes Indians in the past in a kind of static way. It doesn't account for the ways in which American Indian nations are dynamic and moving and changing, the ways that they've become and regenerate themselves in a similar fashion to the American nation. But in their own distinct fashion, of course, depending on their own histories and what they choose to preserve about those histories. Being able to say that Lumbee origins is the primary or only thing that matters about our past sort of misses the point. What we have are traces of history. And it's okay that there's no answer. You know, these questions are also applied to Lumbees and not to others, not to other American Indian tribes, because of a distinct set of double standards that exists, in particular related to the South as a biracial region. I think the more important question is, how did Lumbees come to affirm their distinct identity amidst a community that was otherwise considered black and white? Because that helps explain much more about our present moment, as well as more accurate depictions of what happened in the past. So it's sort of like a question of what matters more. Does it matter more where we come from, or does it matter more that we still exist, that we're still here? And, you know, we are the story of how we came to be.
Right. In the course of this chapter, one of a couple of different, in a sense, origin stories that are told springs from a moment in the life of one George Lowry, and two of his sons had recently been murdered, and he had just emerged from some kind of court hearing and evidently made some kind of dramatic statement about the history of his own people and the kindness that they had shown towards whites, kindness that was not always rewarded and in mm-hmm. some ways, in a very bitter sort of way, turned on its head. But one of the things that he is touching on in this statement, at least the way it was recorded and passed on down, is the possibility, and an intriguing possibility it is, that somehow the origins of the Lumbee Indians are tied up in the so-called lost colony, and that perhaps the Lumbee Indians, at least in large part, are descendants of those lost colonists, mm-hmm. and which would seek, apparently, one of the ways in which this story makes sense to some is it would help explain the Lumbee Indians' similarity to Europeans. Could you just kind of untangle all of that, even though we just got done saying that the ultimate origins of the Lumbee Indians cannot be known, and we shouldn't be spending too much time with some of these stories in a sense. Yeah. This one is just particularly interesting, and in particular, the reason why it sprang up in the first place.
Yeah, well, it's also, I think that the story itself is a way of saying that the origins can be known if we just simply look at what people have said, what Lumbee people have said, and what George Lowry said in that emotional moment of his following the inquest of his son's murder, was that our people came from Roanoke, and there's Roanoke Island, of course, which is where the lost colony landed first, established their first settlement, and the place from which they later disappeared. And then you have the Roanoke River in North Carolina and Virginia, which are two quite distinct places. And no one bothered to ask George Lowry which Roanoke he meant when he said that. And so the assumption has been that because George Lowry made that statement about Roanoke, he meant Roanoke Island, which was to connect essentially the history of our people to the disappearance of these few English colonists in the 1580s. The justification at the time for making that connection between Roanoke Island and the lost colonists and our American Indian community was that there was a need to find that singular origin place to affirm the kind of legitimacy of Lumbees as a separate racial group. It was important. This story was recorded in 1865 and later kind of spread in the 1880s. And it was important in the 1880s, as racial segregation was getting off the ground, to be able to say the Lumbees are a distinct mixture of Indian and white that justifies their segregation, that justifies their exclusion essentially from white privileges, but that also meant that they could have separate schools, they could have things that would support their own autonomy as a group. And tying our history to that lost colony moment was a way of describing us in terms that people in the 1880s needed to understand, not even necessarily Lumbees in the 1880s or Lumbees in the 1580s and those earlier our ancestors when they were encountering that group of Europeans. The other revealing thing about George Lowry's origin story is the Roanoke River side of it. And there were dozens, if not hundreds, of Indian tribes that lived in that region of North Carolina and Virginia, some of which are most likely our ancestors. We just can no longer, because of the documentary record, we could no longer name a single one. But we have Tuscarora ancestors that are from the Roanoke River region. We have Shiraw ancestors that moved around the Roanoke River region. And we have lots of other ancestors from various tribal villages that were among the first affected by European settlement. So there were not very many survivors of that process. And what happened was in that process of colonization, Native people acquired cultural traits that were similar to their new European neighbors. And that was partly a matter of survival, adapt to the people who are now in control so that you can maintain your sense of self, your land, your families, et cetera. But it was also, you know, it's also a testament to the fact that Native people, like all communities, change. And in history, or most people's understanding of American history, we don't give Native people very much credit for changing. We believe that they're, you know, they're true Natives, they're real Indians, if they don't change. You know, if they somehow maintain their original rituals. Well, no culture anywhere does that, right? Like, there's this kind of question of where we come from is hypocritically applied to Lumbees and some other tribes, especially in the South or on the East Coast, because folks, the whole point was for us to disappear. And one of the, you know, one of the ways to help that process along is to make us invisible or to make us irrelevant. And being described as a community that doesn't change is a really good way to make people irrelevant. So, you know, our similarity to Europeans is really The lost colony connection is an oversimplification of that. It was much more of a process that went on for hundreds of years that is about acculturation. It's about Native people becoming more similar to Europeans, but also Europeans becoming more similar to Natives. And that's part of why we have the distinct type of American society we do, is because when Europeans came over here, they really did have to deal with Native people and were changed by them as well.
I wonder if you could maybe draw a distinction for us between the way some of this played out for the Lumbee Indians specifically versus other tribes in other parts of the country. I'm thinking especially of some of the well-known tribes of the, for instance, the Upper Midwest or the Rocky Mountain region and so on. In what way and why did this play out differently for the Lumbee Indians, to whatever extent it did play out differently?
Yeah, I think it played out differently partly because much of this tremendous cultural change, and in particular the death and tragedy that went along with it, predated the founding of the United States. So when the United States federal government came onto the scene, it had an approach, not necessarily always a coherent approach, or certainly not a positive approach, to American Indian tribes that it considered foreigners because they resided outside the bounds of the United States. So I think many of the tribes in the Upper Midwest, for example, their first contact with Europeans was certainly well before the United States, but we have many, many records and a certain type of their histories as related to the federal government have been influenced by the ways in which they were considered outsiders or foreign nations or ultimately domestic dependent nations by the United States. Our ancestors, our Lumbee ancestors, were American citizens at the founding of the United States because they owned land privately, for example. So rather than having land in common or living on land that became a reservation or being moved onto a reservation, Lumbee Indians held land within families, and they passed that land down over the generations. And citizenship went along with property in those early days of the United States. So because we possessed property, we were also citizens, at least before a certain point in North Carolina history. And that citizenship status meant that our tribal history kind of flew under the radar, as it were, for the early United States government. We were not visible to the United States because we were not considered enemies, at least not all the time, and we were not lying outside the boundaries, the ever-changing boundaries of the United States. So that's one, I think, important difference. And it has to do with the ways in which not so much Europeans interacted with Natives generally, because the tribes in the Upper Midwest had fascinating and important transformational moments when it came to European empires of various kinds, the French, the British, and, you know, later the American state. But particularly in the South, that sense of profound change happened well before the United States was ever thought of as an entity.
We're speaking with Dr. Melinda Maynor Lowry and talking about her most recent book, which is called The Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle. There is a lot tied up in that subtitle, An American Struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what, of course, we need to explore in our last few minutes here. Explain to our listeners what, in a sense, the heart and soul of that struggle was, and to some extent, I'm sure, continues to this very day.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. I mean, it's a struggle for visibility. It's a struggle to be acknowledged as equally foundational to the American promise as any other American group. And it's also a struggle for the way we think about American society. So if we think of American society as a nation of immigrants, the American Indian point of view, or that of the Lumbees that I'm trying to speak to in this book, really tells the story of America as a nation of nations. And that nation of nations paradigm forces you to think about the each citizen's responsibility in a slightly different way. We're not only accountable to our fellow individual citizens, we're also accountable to these nations that predated the existence of the United States. And so if we're going to be citizens of the United States, we also have obligations to those nations that are original to this land. And so American Indians, and certainly the Lumbees, as I discuss it here, are struggling for an acknowledgement that their stories and histories are equally powerful and determining as we think about what American society will do now and in the future. I also think the struggle is a kind of ebb and flow of partnership and relationship with Americans, and sometimes alienation and violence with Americans. So I think most American citizens can plug into some part of that struggle, that kind of back and forth between being proud to belong to this society, being very grateful and have a deep sense of appreciation for what's been built here, but also feeling alienated or occasionally just completely opposed to what is going on here. And so I wanted to demonstrate how the Lumbee people have also felt that sort of dual sense of responsibility and their attachments to the United States.
Hmm. I would love to hear you talk a little further about this matter of federal recognition of the Lumbee tribe and what that kind of recognition from the federal government would mean or would have meant, why it mattered, and also the controversy that has kind of swirled around that, the fact that that the Lumbee tribe have, in your words, have long argued that the criteria the federal government uses to judge the authenticity of an Indian tribe's political or cultural existence is deeply flawed.
So I think the purpose of federal recognition is to provide American Indian communities with a government-to-government relationship with the United States. And that government-to-government relationship is kind of mandated by the U.S. Constitution. So essentially Congress was given the power in the Constitution to negotiate with Indian tribes and foreign governments. So that puts Indian tribes and foreign governments in the same kind of category, that both require a nation-to-nation kind of relationship. American Indians are a kind of racial group bound by heritage and culture, but we're also a political communities that include citizens that have distinct rights within the United States political landscape because of our originality, because of our indigenousness on this land. And so what federal recognition would do for Lumbees is to actually fulfill that kind of promise, is for the federal government to say, we recognize the Lumbee people as a distinct government with autonomy and the powers of self-determination. It also means that along with that are distinct opportunities available to those political communities that are not available to other American groups. Because we're not just an ordinary kind of group. We're a kind of group that predates the United States, and we're a kind of group that governs itself distinctly. And so we have to have this sort of federal recognition as a kind of diplomatic relationship in one way that provides for fair treatment under the auspices of the United States and under the auspices of federal authority. It also has problems, and one of the problems that you highlighted is a kind of unequal application of this principle of who is eligible for kind of nation-to-nation acknowledgement. The Lumbees have been subject over time to so many shifting definitions of what an American Indian tribe was that I've kind of started to oversimplify the problem by saying it's not the Lumbees' problem to prove that we're Indians. The problem is the federal government's to decide on what an Indian is and what an Indian tribe is. And we've had a process in place since 1978 that can help move that question forward, but it's not well understood, even by the people in Congress who have a degree of, anyway, not exclusive oversight of it, but have a degree of oversight. But it's not a well-understood process, and it's not necessarily transparent to people who would otherwise be able to participate in the process, people like the Lumbees. So there's other legal routes, too, to recognition. And it's because the issue is so fraught with history, and it requires a relatively understanding of a complex history, distinctly complex history, it's easy for people to kind of tune out and say federal recognition is just about a racial preference. But it's not about a racial preference, because American Indians are political communities that have citizens. Their racial ancestry does not matter as much as many of their kind of unique and important ties to a community. And how those tribes define themselves really should be left up to the tribes. And the federal government needs to provide a process that will allow that self-definition to kind of come to the fore.
Certainly the matter of race comes up again and again, and very early in the book, actually, you write these intriguing words: without a hierarchy of race, there is no need for race. Lumbees have rejected that hierarchy and their place in it throughout their history, but they do not reject racial difference, and sometimes they have used it to their advantage. I think that speaks to how this is a matter that we need to be careful not to treat too simplistically.
Right. And I think, of course, the notion of race can be very useful as people come together to form ideas and strategies and agendas that will benefit people in their community. But the reality of race in America is that no one has pure heritage. We have a process in which people have been discussed or talked about as white, or people have been discussed or talked about as black. But many of those same people, of course, have ancestry that's of another race. It just so happens that at a particular historical moment, one might be able to identify oneself in a certain way, but that doesn't necessarily reflect ancestry. American Indians are subject to the same kinds of historical reinvention. So my great-great-grandfather was called Indian on the 1900 census and white on the 1910 census and Indian again on the 1920 census. And that sort of demonstrates how fluid these racial categories really are, the fact that an outsider would come in and name him different things that did not always be similar to the way that he talked about himself, was just a way of saying that races exist for the purpose of ranking people into a hierarchy. People who otherwise have very similar ancestry, people who otherwise have almost exactly the same DNA. The idea of race is useful when you start to think about ranking people according to what they deserve and what they maybe don't deserve. It's less useful when you think about how to include people. It's a very useful concept to think about excluding people from certain privileges. It's a lot less useful when you think about how to include people. And so one of the lessons I think we learned from Lumbee history is how a nation of folks, the Lumbee Nation, has gone about a process of including American Indians, but also people of other races in our society, as we've decided to govern ourselves and move forward in a self-determining way. Does that help?
Absolutely, absolutely.
I don't know if I got to all your questions.
No, absolutely. We should also acknowledge the fact, I think, that there has been I think we've already touched on this, that there have been some sharp divisions within the Lumbee tribe, within its population, sometimes over these very issues and how best to address them. And I appreciate that complexity is also explored in your book, because certainly those of us on the outside looking in tend to be completely unaware of those sorts of complications in all of this, as if it weren't complicated enough already.
Right.
Maybe we could just have you touch briefly on one of the most dramatic chapters in the book, the chapter called Integration or Disintegration, subtitled Civil Rights and Red Power, in which, for instance, we read about the Lumbee Indians confronting the Ku Klux Klan. I'm afraid we don't have time to go into it in very much detail at all, but I just think this will give our listeners a sense of just the kinds of things that you explore in this book.
Yeah, so Lumbees have been fighting white supremacy since white supremacy became a thing on this continent. But in particular, in the civil rights era, it became a heightened issue when our ancestors confronted the Ku Klux Klan, who had organized a rally in our territory. And we decided to ambush them, essentially. They were armed, and we were armed as well. And that ambush shut down the rally, and the Klan has not held a public rally in Robeson County ever since then. That was in 1958. But, you know, Lumbees were participants in the civil rights movement in that way, in terms of resisting this kind of overwhelming sense that whites deserved more opportunities than non-whites. But sometimes we were also complicit with white supremacy, or at least we were willing to go along with it if it meant being able to protect the schools that had been formed in the name of segregation about 60 years earlier. So that desire to protect those schools meant that sometimes we were, it seemed anyway, that we were coordinating with the forces of white supremacy. And as a historian, this was especially difficult to untangle because you have many of the same people doing both kinds of things. And, you know, what does that mean, especially for us in our current moment? You know, America is quite divided, sharply divided, and we wouldn't assume anything else. We think of a functioning political structure as divided because that's how we get to compromise, or that's how we get to collaboration and problem solving, is to have divisions. Well, Native nations are similar. You know, we also have divisions, and we also have people that change their minds, that adopt different strategies, that are trying to adapt to the forces that are imposed upon them. And when you think of Lumbees as a nation, as a political community, it becomes a little easier to reconcile these contradictions, to say that, yes, both of these kinds of attitudes can exist within the same society, because we see them very prevalently in our own American society. Hmm.
I want to finish with a really interesting quote from the book that really has got me thinking, and even beyond the scope of your particular book. It is, again, in that chapter we touched on earlier about the origins of the Lumbee tribe. You write this at one point: the needs and uses of history are ever-changing, like water. Water does not respect politics or politeness. It goes where it must.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that as you have explored the history of your own people, you've come to realize that even more, the truth of
yes.
that.
Yes. In our current moment with this flooding, we see it on our very landscape. It's just like Mother Nature is in control. The water is in control. It will go where it must go. And history I use that metaphor to think about history as a way not just to think about what happened in the past, or to kind of archive it and put it away and never think about it again. History doesn't allow us to do that. It's always present in our lives. It goes where it must, you know. So when we, at this moment, when we have a Supreme Court nomination that's sort of very similar to what we've seen before in 1991, history is going where it must go, and it's reminding us that it's always going to be with us, even if we try to leave it behind. It will not be left behind.
Right. And I want to leave our listeners with this last thought about the Lumbee homeland. A beautiful moment in the book when you say the Lumbee homeland is best imagined in many layers as something to be remembered and felt rather than as a map of places that can only be seen. Mm-hmm. So in many respects, in many different dimensions, I think your book offers us a very rich, layered look at the Lumbee Indians, past and present, and all that makes them a complex and beautiful people. The book, again, is titled The Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle, published by the University of North Carolina Press. The author, Dr. Melinda Maynard Lowry. Professor Lowry, thank you so much for writing this book and for being part of the morning show today.
Oh, thank you, Greg. I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Jack Rose and Janet DeLeo, who are co-presidents of the Kenosha chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness. This is National Mental Illness Awareness Week, and we will be talking with them about all that NAMI offers. On Thursday, we'll be talking about the 2018 Racine County Sports Hall of Fame. Their big event is coming up later in the month. On Friday, Kenosha's own Michael